Welcome to the Navit Gaming Podcast, where it is our mission to explore the business and future of video games. We bring together the industry's brightest builders, investors, and thinkers to keep a pulse on current events, dissect emerging trends in games, share lessons learned, and have a great time. This podcast is also part of Navit's growing ecosystem, which ranges from free and premium research to consulting and advisory services. For more information, visit www.navic.co. This episode is brought to you by Lightspeed Venture Partners. Lightspeed is a globally leading venture capital firm with over $29 billion in capital under management and more than 500 investments across the US, Europe, and Asia. With its dedicated gaming practice, Lightspeed Gaming, the firm is investing from over $7 billion in early and growth stage capital, making it by far the largest fund focused on gaming and interactive technology. Lightspeed's team combines deep expertise in gaming with a global multi-stage investment platform and a culture that truly puts founders first. Selected investments include Epic Games, Snap, and Stability AI, as well as game designers and producers who led the creation of titles like Fortnite, Call of Duty, League of Legends, Valorant, StarCraft II, and many more. For more information, simply go to gaming.lsvp.com or check out the details in the show notes. And with that, let's jump into the episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another Navic Roundtable. I'm your host, Devin Becker, and with me, of course, excellent guests as we usually have here, Aaron and Anil. How you guys doing?
Howdy. Great.
Yeah, looking forward to rocking the AA power today.
The AA power, that's right. If only my name started with it. Or we could have another D on here. We could be D-cells, but... we got GDC coming up. I'm sure a lot of you excited. I will be there, and I believe Aaron will be there.
Yeah, I will be there too. So quick plug, if you want to chat with me, chat with Navic about working with us in some way, whether you want to explore our consulting, some type of partnership, whether it's content related, whatever is on your mind, please let us know. We'll attach a link in the show notes. So it's just a quick form, fill it out, let us know. Let us know what you're interested in, and I will do my best to get back to you. I can't promise that I will be able to have time for everyone that submits. Time is scarce, unfortunately, but I'll make sure to get back to you no matter what. And even if we can't meet at GDC, maybe we can find another time.
Awesome. I've set up my own form just for play dates or something. Definitely going to be it's going to be a busy GDC from what I've heard from everyone. The attendance, at least from the crowd that we run in, is going to be very high, I think. This is probably the GDC I've been asked if I'm going to GDC the most.
It's usually a sign
that everyone's going for the most
part. Yeah, I can echo those sentiments. It feels a lot bigger than last year.
Is funny given that the layoffs, you'd think people would be like, I can't afford to go now because I don't work in the game industry temporarily. Something like that but it doesn't seem to be the case. It seems like a lot of people are like, this is just an opportunity then to rectify that potentially.
Yeah, I think as well, it's like the broader story. Times are changing in the games industry, and maybe that means it is time for some bold moves and big announcements. And I wouldn't be surprised if we saw some of those. I hope so in GDC.
Yeah, time to bring out the big guns. Really capture the attention of everyone with good news. Yeah. Well, speaking of good news, we have some positive news in here. It's a bit of a mix, but in general, as usual, lots of things happening in the game industry. I don't think this year started off quiet, and I don't think it's going to end quiet either. I think this is going to be, as you just said, a pretty busy year. Why don't we just jump into the first thing here, which is maybe I'm not on the positive side, but it will be interesting to see where it goes, which is Nintendo, as everyone knows, is not a big fan of emulators unless they're the ones selling the ROMs on their virtual console or Nintendo Online thing. In this case, I guess reasonably looking at it as a piracy tool rather than as a collector's fan sort of thing, have sued the pants off pretty much Yuzu, a Switch emulator, for over $2 million is what they ended up settling on. And of course, that emulator is just done at this point. There's no way it's going to keep doing it. And that has already also shut down their 3DS emulator that they had on the same umbrella. And basically, through chilling effect, shut down multiple other emulators, even shut down conversations about emulators, in this case, like on Steam Deck and just fan-based channels. Pretty much the definition of a chilling effect from a lawsuit. We'll see where this goes. But this was definitely, while just chump change to Nintendo, it's definitely a pretty big blow to emulators, which I'm not sure how much they were making, but I don't think it was this level. And this is definitely a sort of punishment level, I think, loss in terms of the amount for the type of thing. And so in this case, obviously emulators are not necessarily a big business or anything like that in terms of the way people are looking at it. It's not necessarily something that drives business. But as I mentioned with the virtual console that was a thing before, Nintendo is one of the few companies that is selling essentially emulated versions of their games. Other companies tend to package them in like collectors, whether it be like a pack of a few games or remasters, whatever. Nintendo's like, okay, we will basically emulate and sell you access to that, which to be fair, then that's them saying, we have a reason to sue you because you're basically pirating what we are actively selling. It's not outdated things that are no longer accessible, which of course makes back true. In this case, Switch games, of course, are not a virtual console. That's still a legit business. And you don't even see Nintendo even mark their own games down when they're old. The idea of someone emulating them for the price of zero obviously doesn't sit well. But I guess the question is there anything you guys think this could have an effect on the games business in a minor or major way that is maybe not obvious?
I think it can do in a kind of unusual way. From a business standpoint, no, it doesn't. It's a very small fry with the amount of sums that we're talking about. But I do think this is an interesting story for a few reasons. I do feel that one thing we've seen recently is, look at Sony. Sony do now release their games on PC. Perhaps they have a one-year exclusivity on their home console before they go to PC. But with the industry becoming more and more consolidated and margins getting lower, the ability to grow your revenue outside your own primary platform is something that many companies are looking into. Now, Nintendo have never done that. They've always resisted the urge to do that for years. They really protect their own platform, like almost to a mafiosi level. And that one of the reasons why PlayStation became a thing is because people were fed up of paying for the charges. So look, the emulator, I think people might not openly say it, but I think piracy probably was the number one thing people were using it for. But I do have to say that I know of quite a big use case of many people that did own a Switch and even did own the games, but liked using the emulators because you could play the games on your PC. And it also meant that you could up-res the games and make it look better. So, for example, I remember seeing one of the Zelda games running on this emulator with some custom mods on it. And the game already looks beautiful, but it looked absolutely stunning. And this is not something that they like to facilitate. So I do wonder if it's, look, is it going to come back and bite Nintendo? Absolutely not. But I wonder if they are quite an old-fashioned traditional company in that sense. And perhaps there could be something there. Look, the reality is that these guys dialed back on the emulators basically over right away. But not only that, it spooked every other emulation project out there. It is also notable that a lot of Japanese companies, they tend to clamp down on fan projects as well. You sometimes get things like, oh, someone's trying to do like Streets of Rage 2 remake of a 25-year-old game. And they'll be like, nope, you can't do it, even though that code is there. But you could say that another case of emulation I can think of that I thought was actually quite successful was MAME. So if you remember that, that's like the arcade ROM emulator that happened many years ago. And now many people own things like MAME cabinets at home where you can play lots of games. And I felt that kind of had a bit of a resurgence in retro gaming in general. And now you get things like the retro consoles that people made and they sell quite well around Christmas. So going off on a bit of a tangent here, but I think there is something to be said there that maybe this is speaking to, maybe Nintendo look at it as just piracy, but there could be something else there that they could tap into and going a bit broader and not just trying to make people only buy Nintendo-based products.
Yeah, someone who owns one of those kind of MAME cabinets here, but also owns all of the classic consoles, like the SNES Classic, things like that. I also own the actual hardware still. This place is like a museum sometimes when it comes to the fact that I have a Virtual Boy here, like that. It was a legit one I owned. Still have my original Game Boy that came with Tetris. But that doesn't stop me from still having these things. Maybe even out of convenience. Maybe I know that the wear and tear on those systems is ridiculous and I don't want to play it on those systems for fear of just destroying it. Or maybe I want to play it on my phone. There is definitely use cases. And I also wonder how many people bought, say, the SNES Classic, which of course Nintendo profited from, purely to then also add emulated games to it, right? Like Nintendo still made the money from it. And then you also wonder about like Nintendo's Switch Online. Nintendo Online emulator on Switch is built off the backs of basically, I think, an open source Linux-based emulator. And so they certainly do benefit from the technology. But at the same time, I do wonder if this is just Nintendo, is it still a free game on Sega or any of those, especially with Sega not even having the hardware anymore? Or maybe if it's Japanese companies, maybe outside of that, although most of them are Japanese companies, Sega, Sony, Nintendo, that's hard to find. I don't think anyone's emulating Xbox when you could already probably play the games on Windows anyways, but I digress. It'll be interesting to see if there is knock-on effects. I do think there is obviously some talent loss, perhaps, from that. even when it comes to, like you said, the remixes. Or I always think of Christian Whitehead, who was famous for his Sega emulators that he did. So good that Sega hired him, and he was a big part of Sonic Mania. And that, I thought that was great. That was how you do it. Basically the complete opposite of what Nintendo did. But that being said, Nintendo's free to do what they want with their property, and there's a good reason why they do it. But I do wonder if this is not as much of a positive for Nintendo as they would like. I don't think they were losing a ton of money over it, but clearly they do think they were. So they might have better numbers on that than I would.
Nintendo often do unusual stuff like this, though. Like, another one that's loosely connected is, you know, loads of fighting game players loved Smash Brothers, and they like some of the older games, and they wanted to run their own tournaments for it. And Nintendo actually won't run official tournaments for the game because it's not seen in their image. And I feel like any other company would embrace that and build out some sort of sub, you know, division in their company to handle it in a respectful way. And they're like, no, we're not touching this with a 20-foot pole. It's just very interesting. Like I say, they're a very traditional company, but look, they're so successful that you can't really blame them for their moves that they make.
It's like the dark side of fandom. It's like something that Disney deals with all the time too, right? Mm-hmm. Where as a company that's similar, or even Apple, like the more popular you are and people trying to celebrate that popularity might be doing it in ways that you're not happy about. And then you've got to slap down your own fans just to keep everyone under control. So I will see how it goes. But in terms of cross-platform things in a more positive light, Netflix has actually been continuing to throw money at its own ports over to mobile.
Yeah, so let me take this one. So I found this very interesting news. So Netflix is going to be publishing and launching Hades, which is by Supergiant Games. That game's been out for a while. It's coming out at the end of this month, March the 19th, as an iOS exclusive. So I find this interesting for a couple of reasons. One, I feel like Hades is like a super well-established game. It's the darling of many people, but also quite a commercial success, I would say, for a small studio. Like I own it twice. I can say that right now. I think it's a brilliant game. I play it on my Steam Deck quite a lot. So I think it coming to mobile makes a lot of sense. And this is not something that they've rushed. They've taken like a full year to develop it. They say that they really try to make it work to be best in class, and the other things like haptic controls. So I find this a bit unusual why this has been done with Netflix, because I feel like Supergiant could release it themselves and not have to be at the mercy of some sort of, you know, logins or sign-ins or having things like this. So there's probably more coming down the line. Well, what else do Netflix do? Do they do animated series? Do they do other tie-ins? Could they do a push? So look, I think from Netflix's point of view, I think this is a huge pickup. I do know that they have done some other published games in the past, but I think in terms of both quality and status, this is a really big one, I feel. I'm quite interested to see what happens with this. And I think it'll be quite successful, I've got a feeling. And I'm curious, like, what sort of tie-ins they have related to this release and what's next, because I feel like if they're going for this one, what else do they have in store? I think there's probably some other quite juicy stuff coming down the line, and I think this is a real signal of intent for me from what they're going to be doing coming forwards.
Yeah, it makes sense to me, given that Hades wouldn't be successful on mobile, given it's a premium game, really. And so it makes sense to be bundled with something like Netflix, which would automatically give it potentially a very large audience. And for a smaller studio, whatever sum of money Netflix is handing over for it is probably pretty worthwhile to them. And also, I'm not that surprised on the Netflix front either. I think this is the kind of thing we're going to see much more often from them. Obviously, as we talked about many times, like, they're still experimenting, they're finding their footing with their strategy, their business model, all of that. And that is going to continue evolving for a while. But the strategy, really, just like on a most basic nuts and bolts level, it was always going to start with licensing, like very simple things, and then grow its way up to licensing even better games such as Hades now, which, you know, won Game of the Year, like it's an awesome game, you know, to, you know, from there, similar to what they did in video, then branching off to making their own games, which we're starting to see more of. But that, of course, takes time to really unfold, and they're still figuring it out. And the biggest question mark with Netflix, honestly, is the UX more than anything, especially for like how people are going to play games on TVs. That's the ultimate thing to solve for. But these types of pickups, I think, will become more normal for Netflix in the months ahead, which is really interesting. And it does open a window for potentially more premium games being ported to mobile in a way that could just immediately make sense and be a differentiator for Netflix too.
I mean, it makes sense as well to target the high end of AA in terms of popularity without, because I can imagine what they spend for it is definitely better in terms of value. If they're like, hey, we're bringing better like value to our brand in terms of the quality of games we're bringing over without having to bring over the high end in terms of AAA. Now, that being said, they still brought over GTA San Andreas, but that's an older title, right? So they're trying to find that sweet spot where they're like, they're not trying to bring Call of Duty over to Netflix, but they're definitely going to bring stuff that they know people like that is high quality, but also not super crazy to port, generally like 2D or like isometric in the case of Hades. And Hades wasn't even necessarily the first one in that sort of genre. Dead Cells kind of was the one they did before and was a good test case. And that probably helped get the Hades deal going in terms of if that did well, then they're probably like, okay, then we obviously have an audience for this type of game. And also there's the reverse of what you're talking about, I know, where in this case, for example, it is a little bit of a missed opportunity, as I joked with you before, about Dead Cells and the Castlevania DLC not existing on mobile yet, despite the Castlevania anime. And there's still ample opportunity for that DLC to be brought over and that tie-in to be made. But if they see a huge pickup, for example, in Hades, the game being played, because they'll have all the analytics for that, which Netflix loves, those numbers to decide what to produce, they can go, hey, now we can justify producing a Hades anime, right? They don't have to decide immediately ahead of time. And this also leads in for Supergiant. This is a no-brainer because, as Aaron said, they get the money to do the port, support with the port. They also get extra media attention from Netflix doing it, as we're talking about it right now. But also, they're supposed to be releasing the second one approximately in Q2. So this is like, hey, cool, free promotion with the old one. Get people excited about it. Hopefully an audience that hasn't already played the game, maybe just Netflix people looking and go, hey, what can I play off this? Now suddenly our brand recognition of Hades 2 comes out. I don't think Netflix is paying to immediately port it to mobile, but this is like a win situation, especially for AA and Indian. There's been some other great games like Into the Breach, Moonlighter, The Ninja Turtles Shredder's Revenge, which was like a great indie, like a sequel, remake, whatever you want to call it. And then, as I mentioned, the GTA games. So I think they've been doing a pretty good job of bringing at least some good recognizable ones, even if they're bringing sometimes IP with the twist. The previously mentioned Rainbow Six Siege Small World, or like some of the other weird ones like the Shovel Knight one, things like that. They're definitely targeting that sort of indie crowd or the high level indie quality stuff. So they have a strategy, it seems like, at least. As you said, Aaron is probably looking to go up if they find success with it in terms of
for now.
What they're willing to spend.
Because you said like, they're not targeting Call of Duty. Like one of my like spicy takes that I think I've shared before is that Ubisoft now has the cloud streaming rights to Call of Duty for the next decade. Like, I actually feel like there's much higher odds than people think that someone like Netflix, like Ubisoft will sell will sell access to a Netflix. Again, it's just all about the UX and solving for that, especially on TVs. But if Netflix is serious and does solve for it, it's important to remember that 10 years ago, Netflix barely had any first-party video content. And what they did have, they didn't even make themselves. They basically just funded it. They produced it, but they didn't develop it. And look where they are now as the largest video content creators in the world. And so if they are serious about games, what could happen over the next decade? This is an interesting step, but the ceiling is going to become much higher in terms of what they're willing to do, given they have perhaps the largest or one of probably the largest paying audience base for content in the world. Massive global scale, multi-platform, and the largest or one of the largest content budgets the entertainment industry has ever seen. That's only going to get larger in the coming years as they continue to scale. And what that means for games, I still think people are sleeping on like the optionality that Netflix has here, even though it doesn't really make much sense what we're seeing so far in a lot of cases from their strategy, and it's just a lot of questions. Is to say those questions can't really be answered and solved for in a way that leads to bigger moves. So I think it'll be interesting.
Yeah. Like you said, they started with the stuff that was native to mobile, and then they started bringing stuff over to mobile, and then sky's the limit from there if they could figure out that UI UX, which they clearly wanted to do with game controllers that they were trying to do for TV play. We've talked a bit about that before. Like, they've clearly shown their ambitions. It's just a question of whether or not they're able to execute on them in timely fashion. But it does come down to the question of money. You talk about them spending all this money on content and all that, and then suddenly they're cracking down on password sharing, jacking up the price of subscriptions, trying to look at ad monetization models. Clearly, like, this is not making them extra money as much as they liked, so much as trying to continue to grow that market share and hold on to it. But they've got to have monetized some of it. And so I do imagine if they look to continue to scale up those game acquisitions or spend on the game, at some point that leads to then finding ways to further monetize that and not just give it away completely for free as like part of the subscription, or just another tier of Netflix where you're like, oh, plus games.
Yeah. My other spicy take that is probably even less likely is that, and I have said part of this before too, which is that I think the writing is on the wall with Xbox over the next generation or two. They're going to exit hardware, primarily become a services company. And Microsoft's going to look at that and think about, we're a multi-trillion dollar company. Like, how can we make this move the needle? And it'll make sense for them to merge gaming and video together somehow. And Netflix will be there. Xbox will be there. Maybe there's a little interesting type of merger or something that could happen and take Game Pass to the next level with Netflix too. Something like that sounds really wacky and weird today. But again, like 5 years from now, or 10 years from now even, I think that's going to be pretty normal in an increasingly transmedia world that we'll be living in.
As long as it means mobile remasters of a lot of the Sega CD FMV games, then I'm okay with that. Get some Sewer Shark on here. And I will see it. I think it's definitely, like you said, the trajectory for some of these companies seems pretty clear. It's just how they execute and get there that we might see some stumbles along the way. But when it comes to acquisitions and stumbling and things like that, I think there was a few things you wanted to talk about around Saber and Jagex.
Yeah. Let me find my notes for that. So, yeah, just piecing together a couple news items that have happened over the past couple weeks. Previously, a couple weeks ago or so, it was mentioned that Jagex, which owns all things RuneScape, that they sold to new private equity owners for about $900 million or so. And Jagex is a business, like, it's been like a big game of hot potato of like, who will own them at any given time. So it's not that surprising. Still notable that like they continue to be in these deals. But more recently, it was announced that Embracer is selling Saber Interactive for $500 million. Saber Interactive, they're making the Knights of the Old Republic remake and such. And part of this conversation could be about like how Embracer is just selling this. They're looking to sell Gearbox. They're really just becoming a shell of themselves. And that's
fire sale.
Yeah. Fire sale, save the company somehow, and you end up in a worse position than you really started. So that's awkward. But instead of talking about that, you know, I just want to talk about like connecting the dots between these deals, but even like some of what I've seen elsewhere. Haveli Private Equity Group acquiring Candyvore, which made Match Masters. And over the past few years, there's been like the pendulum swung very heavily towards venture capital. And venture capital, when the market was booming, was like the primary investment type to scale companies, start companies, and really just fuel the industry. And that, of course, leads to either getting acquired by the big companies, these growth by acquisition companies, big publishers, whoever, or going public. And really what we've seen is the pendulum swing back in the other direction in all of those categories, which is that if the industry as a whole isn't growing as much, then venture capital isn't going to be as active, which means that also like exit opportunities are not going to be as plentiful. The Embracers of the world, they're not buying companies like they were. Even like the Tencents of the world, just for their own regulatory reasons, are not buying companies the same way that they were in the past. And so what we're seeing right now is really like a new type of investor that's not that new, but I still feel like it's becoming more prominent and not discussed, which is private equity coming into the industry and silently making some moves and becoming the owners of these notable IPs, these forever franchises in some way. I think it's notable. And on one hand, private equity emerges from the shadows when times are tough. It come in, buy companies that usually are more struggling or flatlining, and they make money by less focusing on growth and more focusing on how to make those companies more profitable and how to operationalize them more effectively. And it leads to good cash flow generating returns for them, or they spin it off, sell it off again to the next buyer in some way, take it public. There's usually another step after private equity. But also just like in the case of Haveli and Candyvore with Mesh Masters, that's sort of like it leaned more on the venture side of the equation, but it wasn't, they're not a venture capital company. It wasn't a venture deal. And so, you know, I think what we're seeing there is just like, also there are games companies that realize that they don't have to press the gas super hard all the time on venture and just be regularly reinvesting, chasing the moon always. And instead, if you have a great game or games, you can have a great cash flowing business. And there are investors that have a different profile and different desires that might fit that mold better in trying to get more of cash flow returns versus just higher and higher valuation rounds until some type of exit. So anyways, I'm like pointing out different examples, but I do think there is like an interesting through line here of what we're seeing take shape. And the more that the industry continues to struggle with growth and more companies realize that they need to rationalize themselves in some ways, I think that this could become a bigger trend and private equity in small ways and potentially in bigger ways too than even what we're seeing with several hundred million dollar deals. Could become more prevalent in the next few years for our industry. So anyways, curious to get your guys' thoughts on this. Do you think I'm on to something? Are there other ramifications of a new investor type becoming more prominent? What do you think?
I definitely think that it makes sense when you're like, you go through that growth phase when everyone thinks like you can just, as you said, press the gas pedal indefinitely. And then at some point, that can't last forever. Regardless of whether the macro market is working against you or just that you maybe can't find a way to replicate that hit success, but you spend a bunch of money trying to do it. There's a whole bunch of reasons why it just at some point starts to go like, okay, maybe we can't grow super fast anymore. And some people are content to go, let's pull this scale back. Let's just go ahead and do what we do well and continue to double down on that. But then a lot of companies seem to just go, I guess we'll just do layoffs now. Or they get in that sort of like, we're not sure how to proceed from here other than cutting back. And it seems like that's, as you said, public equity or private equity is a great opportunity for someone to come in and be like, hey, we'll help you do that. We'll help you just make this more efficient because you clearly were spending your money wrong. So we will give you some money to spend it correctly and fix that because we want a part of that, right? Because you have something there. You just weren't running your business effectively. We'll run it as a business effectively. It's the mentality, right? And that as you're later on, if you couldn't find a way to continue that success indefinitely, that is the inevitable thing. And obviously we had things like Embracer and stuff try and shortcut that in a different way, and it clearly didn't work out the way they were hoping. There's still obviously some games under there and maybe they'll find some sort of success, but we have, you know, other companies like Gearbox and other ones potentially looking to be jettisoned off as well. And we'll see if it ends up like fire sale kind of situation, but we have some of them like just kind of leaving, some of them looking to be bought by someone else. Like it's a variety of situations, but it does make sense because this is not just the companies Embracer bought. This is like the whole industry right now is in like a tough spot. And I think there's a lot of things that probably pointed the ways to this for a while, like ever increasing production costs, never increasing game prices. There was a whole bunch of market forces making it like, this is going to tighten sooner or later. And maybe the mobile industry made everyone feel like it was going to go on forever. And then COVID certainly accelerated. That was gas on the fire. And everyone admitted they overhired, right? Especially was like, we just hired too much. So someone got to go. So it's a cycle that's inevitable, right? Where then just another type of business steps in. I think it makes sense. And hopefully it's one where it actually keeps these games alive in a form that everyone doesn't just quit and leave. It was funny you pointed at Jagex because it makes me think too, I'm surprised. I wasn't someone who played RuneScape. I was more of an Ultima Online person, but the amount of people I've heard use RuneScape as like a touch base for different things, it clearly has a brand recognition and like potential opportunity to be something. And then I look at Ultima Online still being run, but by Broadsword, partnered with EA, because EA kind of picked it up and kind of dropped that ball. But like these things that have this sort of brand recognition can maybe find someone that runs it more efficiently, like in this case, Broadsword, or maybe someone else can help Jagex run it more efficiently, that it's maybe you could drag this thing on forever if you just don't overspend on it and try and grow it indefinitely. Just run it like a smarter business. If you have a small audience, spend like you have a small audience, right? Don't try, if they're not going to go away, right? If they're just aging into your game and never aging out, it could be for everything. Like the stuff I was talking about with Warhammer, like Warhammer's just dragged around forever. It's never been the best, but it's enough people play it. It just keeps going. It works like that. So I think I hope that actually this actually just keeps these games alive, or it keeps these brands or the employees, and it doesn't lead to more layoffs. That actually just maintaining operational efficiency then means less layoffs.
It will. It'll lead to layoffs for sure. I think that's inevitable. And there's good and bad to private equity too. Like, sometimes becoming more efficient is needed for businesses, and it's just hard times to work through. But yeah, there are other implications of private equity. Different firms work differently, of course, but private equity is usually more debt driven. And so sometimes they'll put companies more at risk and how they deploy debt to finance operations. Sometimes even they'll take on debt, pay a massive dividend with it, and then take it public or something. And then it goes public with a massive debt load. And they got their return because they basically just took the money out of the business. And of course, that doesn't happen always. But there will be weird things like that happen in the games industry as well. So we'll have to see. But I also do think, too, there will be instances where, you know, people with more of that type of background get involved with companies. And I think we've talked about Enad Global 7 in the past as one example. There's like a mini growth by acquisition company compared to an Embracer, and really were just horribly run, destroyed a ton of value, and then bought all sorts of random things. And then their current CEO, Ji Ham, through whatever private equity group, bought in. He stepped into the role of CEO, and he's actually done a pretty phenomenal job in turning around that business so far. It's a very small business today with growth aspirations and such, but we're able to make it sustainable, like regularly profitable, like actually put it on a growth trajectory now that everyone in the company can rally behind when it was directionless before. And we might see more leaders like that emerge in certain places. A lot of this, of course, is like pretty small, but I do think there are opportunities in some larger companies even where like it would actually be pretty helpful and unlock a lot of value if private equity were to go in. And everyone's thinking about Ubisoft, so I'll just say it. Though it's like the biggest example where that would make sense, but probably won't happen because of the family's control of the business. But yeah, a different mindset at a different time for the industry. Will be interesting to see how prominent this group of investors becomes.
I think it's going to obviously be winners and losers, right? It's not going to be one way or the other, and some will work out a lot better than others. And it's the painful period that we got to go through to correct some of the things that just weren't working. And that's the purpose of any kind of recession type behavior, is clean house a little bit. But obviously, like, it will have probably some negative effects on people that probably shouldn't be cleaned house, or they when management is just trying to save their own job through other people that are good under the bus kind of things, because like, they're just going to bleed the rest of it dry. And hopefully that's not common, right? There's different kinds of businesses, and I'm not as familiar with how private equity cleans up like entertainment businesses as opposed to like more operational, like manufacturing business. Like, one example I always think of that was surprised to me is Safeway, a grocery company around here, like grocery stores that I think they're Vons elsewhere and stuff like that. Safeway I always just thought was a good successful company or whatever. And I was like, one time I looked up, who owns Safeway? And I was like, private equity. That could have surprised me. And it certainly wasn't, they didn't run it into the ground. They didn't milk it. Like, Safeway seems like a pretty well-run company. I think it's been like that for a while. I go get my groceries from there. It seems to work fine. But it never seemed like it was a hugely detrimental thing. But that's a different kind of business than entertainment, where you've got this hit-driven up and down thing. It's not like something where you just, all we got to do is keep churning out groceries. And so I hope the right people are picking up from private equity that understand the business, I think is probably the important part. But in the discussion of winners and losers and people that are maybe on the other side of that are doing well, I think we wanted to also discuss, we've talked a lot about the ones that maybe haven't done so well. We've also talked a bit recently about some of the ones that have done better. And I think we wanted to look at, so far into the year, outside of all the people that have maybe had to change positions temporarily, there has been maybe some successes we can look at.
Actually, before we do that, Devin, can we hit on one more topic, which is the Epic versus Apple update? One more loser, potentially, before we dedicate the rest of the episode to winners. So we don't have to spend long on this, but I think it's important to acknowledge, again, that Apple continues its blatant antitrust tactics. So the DMA in Europe, in short, enables companies to build their own competing app stores. Apple initially retaliated by making it prohibitively expensive to do that, charging, I think it was like 27% fees. So basically, like, making it just as expensive for a tougher, clunkier user experience. So to discourage anyone from making their own. app stores. Of course, though, Epic Games, they want to push forward because it's in their ethos. Also, Fortnite isn't allowed on the App Store, and so bringing that back in some way makes a lot of sense for them to do, which also opens up UEFN to that audience again as well on mobile, which will be interesting to see. But it was announced not very long ago at the time of recording that Apple is now taking a step further by revoking Epic's developer account, which would stop them from developing anything on iOS, which is pretty wild. And so I was looking at some of the materials from like emails that were being shared about this. And basically Apple emailed Tim Sweeney and I'll just quote, "Your colorful criticism of our DMA compliance plan coupled with Epic's past practice of intentionally violating contractual provisions with which it disagrees strongly suggests that Epic does not intend to follow the rules. We invite you to provide us with written assurance that you are acting in good faith and that Epic Games will, despite your public actions and rhetoric, honor all of its commitment." And then essentially tell us why should we trust Epic? And then Tim Sweeney responds by saying, "Epic and its subsidiaries are acting in good faith and will comply with all terms of current and future agreements with Apple." And then Apple gets back and just says, "Mr. Sweeney's response to that request was wholly insufficient and not credible." And then it goes on to cite tweets for why that's the case. And on the surface, it's not crazy why Apple wouldn't trust Epic, because Epic did break their rules before. There's a lot of gamesmanship clearly going on here. And it'll go to court. I don't know how it will play out, but clearly anti-competitive behavior that goes against the spirit of what the DMA is trying to allow. And Apple, they continue to find these loopholes, but I don't think it can stand forever. So I'm curious what it'll be like. And obviously, this is bad. Google is maybe not as bad, but also pretty bad too, and certainly not as open with Android as they would want you to believe. But yeah, tough times for Epic still, tough times for mobile at large when Apple continues to crack hard down on developers. But I don't know, big news, important to acknowledge.
It's also worth mentioning that Google has seemed like they're going to behave maybe a little bit better. And then they, of course, in the final hour of the DMA stuff, were like, "Oh, by the way, we're also going to do some of that bad stuff Apple was doing." And Tim Sweeney called them out for that too, so we'll see how his emails back and forth with Google go after this, but I do find it extremely ironic for Apple to use the terms good faith. Pretty hilarious at that point. Just the choice of those words, pretty funny. But they also got slapped down with anti-competitive stuff around the same time today, even pretty big fine for their anti-competitive behavior around music stores too. So this is definitely coming to a head, but we'll see how it shakes out. I think it's going to take a while to come to a fruitful head for anyone at this point.
Yeah, Anil, as the person here with a mobile gaming studio, how are you feeling about the state of all of this going down?
It just feels like two billionaires having a money fight, really. But there has been some big deals and some big rulings, but we've yet to see any evidence come from it. So I think everyone waits to see if that would happen. But yeah, I guess the recurring theme is things aren't right in the games industry right now. So maybe it is going to need something like this to open up a new avenue to start getting things moving in the right direction. That would be nice to see. But at the moment, it gets a bit tiresome just looking at this go on over and over, to be honest.
Yep. And with that, Devin, I'll let you shift the topics back to happy things.
Right. Rainbows and everything right now. I was kicking off with saying that I think we've talked a lot about some of the big surprise winners, and to me, AA is it right now, and I think there's a pretty obvious reason why they're charging less for their games. And so people looking for fun new things to do that don't want to spend $60 only to be extremely disappointed by the release, which has been maybe a little too common when it wasn't something that you could really count on being good. I think it's an inevitable conclusion that's benefiting more talented, creative people in the industry that aren't overspending and under-delivering. Who wants to take a tack at the next happy thought?
I could think of a couple of studios that I think have had a great year and kind of echo what you've just said there. Two that immediately come to mind. First would be Arrowhead Studios, who've made Helldivers 2. I don't know if you ever played the first game. The first game was a very interesting game. It's pretty, polarizing, I would say. Some people loved it, some people hated it. And to see their sequel get to the top of the Steam charts is, I think, phenomenal. Anyone saw that happening. And so that's quite a nice thing to see, that a smaller studio, I would call that a AA game, it was like a digital game, maybe slightly bigger budget for this one, stick to their guns, so to speak, and do so successful and sustain it is really good. Be interesting to see if they get acquired or not. Their CEOs come out today and said they absolutely won't be. And that's exactly what Bungie said about Destiny, didn't they? Until about a month later, they were indeed acquired. So let's see what happens there. So I think that's been like a real success. And similarly, a debutant would be Pocket Pair. If you don't know who they are, they're the guys that made Power World. So that's obviously come up absolutely nowhere. But that game hasn't just been a flash in the pan. It's been in the top 10 Steam sales for quite a while now since it's come out. And many people thought it was just going to be a one and done. So they probably already made more than enough money to cover their costs probably for the next 3 or 4 years. Be interesting to see what happens then. And yeah, what do both of these games and companies have in common? Smaller scale games made, of course, sort of more passion, done on a more sensible budget. They have gameplay at their core or something new that hasn't really been done in the mainstream, and they've achieved success of it. And I do have to say, I feel like that is probably where we're going. I feel like the arms race of trying to get to the hyper-realistic, super-duper quality has basically just ended up in a position where games are too expensive to make. The margins are low. You make one false step and it's catastrophic. So we've got to go back to being maybe a little bit more imaginative and being more about art style rather than hyper-realism. That said, Helldivers is fairly realistic, but again, they haven't gone for super quadruple A standards. I can think of a third one as well, but I'll wait to see what Aaron comes up with.
Yeah, I just want to tack on that real quick. If it had come out this year, I think Baldur's Gate 3 would be probably...
Yeah. Larian Studios, exactly.
Well, let's see. On my draft board of good things for 2024, I think I'll call out Applovin. So Applovin, so far, like we keep track of a public markets gaming index of the top gaming companies, and Applovin is the best performing company of the year so far. It's up about 60% in 2024 so far, and is up way more from its lows. And so it's been really impressive to see how they've adapted with the times and stayed on the cutting edge of mobile UA. And I was reading something Eric Seifert wrote in his blog or newsletter, and basically what he pointed out is that right before Unity merged with Iron Source, the three companies, Unity, Iron Source, and Applovin, they all had about equal market share in their advertising revenues. But if you zoom forward to today, Unity and Iron Source's advertising revenues combined as of the last quarter was only 55% of Applovin's. And so, on one hand, that says something about Unity and Iron Source, about how they've been maybe mishandling a bunch of things, and they've had their own issues in the past couple of years as well, where they broke their algorithm with bad data and had to rebuild it from scratch and various things like that. But also Applovin has just done a pretty masterful job at staying adaptive and creating tooling that works for people. And I think some companies have always taken issue with Applovin for their tactics and or pricing or various things. To their credit, they've maneuvered very well. And from even like pitching, hey, Unity, you should work with us instead of Iron Source, probably maybe good for them that fell through and that they've been able to operate on their own and be away from the Unity mess of late. So yeah, Applovin, in a difficult mobile environment, they are doing a pretty phenomenal job right now. Really impressive.
Definitely hope like we could see more success on mobile, because that's another area. Definitely we've talked a lot of doom on, mostly just because it's been a struggle just based off the way the sort of business model was set up around user acquisition became sensitive. But it is interesting with all of these in the sense of like discovery and finding users can be tricky. And it is interesting to see like Steam, for example, be maybe a better place for some of that, despite the millions of games that seem to get dumped on Steam. But it is weird to see like marketing strategies maybe not even being a factor in that. Like, I don't think Helldivers 2 really had marketing. I was someone who played the first one and all the Magicka games before and stuff, and I had no idea it was coming out till it was out. And so it is interesting that there are still areas where quality could shine. Obviously, virality aspects, like we talked about this before, with like the Pokemon with guns aspect, of PAL world and stuff like that. And it's like you come in with a good hook. In this case, maybe it's Starship Troopers. Maybe it's that's something that people happen to want and some good quality, and actually don't over crazy spend on it to where you can actually, as Anil was saying, not just completely die. Although it does sound like PAL world was maybe hanging by a thread there. I think that's a lesson to some people that if you're not EA or whatever, don't act like you are and shoot for, let's just do a good job. And maybe Steam isn't like as bad a place if you can manage to get to broadly. I was thinking about this the other day, like just the effect of seeing what your friends are playing pop up that notification in the corner. I've noticed it having a pretty strong effect because there's this sort of desire, like, what am I going to play next? What am I going to play next feeling a lot of times these days, as it feels like we churn through games very quickly, that having that sort of what are my friends playing effect or curiosity around it, and Steam's continued, Valve's continued efforts in trying to improve marketing and discoverability on Steam in general, because they actually put effort into it, unlike certain mobile developer mobile platforms that maybe do the opposite. It's really interesting to see that there's some evolution there that could be beneficial to the middle of the industry and not just the top or bottom.
What's next on your draft board, Devin?
Oh man, like I said, I think we've named them all, but it's a kind of a spectrum, right? Because like there was like more higher end ones, like the Baldur's Gate one that I said, where it's like maybe there was a bit higher than or high end of AA, and then you've got all the way down to Balatro, which is like the low end Vampire Survivors type one. And then I still think there's a lot of these, like any kind of horror games that seem to come out with a bit of a splash. And I think it's almost like we talked about before, like this sort of Roblox kind of developer evolving in. And I think that's a positive for the industry to see these sort of indie creators that cut their teeth in this sort of mod kind of world. We always talk about like those of us who used to play mods and like missing mods. And I think having that sort of infrastructure around UGC, whether UGC is a flash in the pan, I think it's like benefiting us getting developers that actually get to test their games in the wild and learn a lot before they start to come in to the scene. So we're not just seeing indies come in from just really liking indie games and making their first one. And I think UEFN could be a big part of that as well. So I think trending into this year, having maybe some of these financial or market like driven ways for indies to cut their teeth, I think could continue the success story. So it's more of like, that's almost more of a trend than a specific game, because you said a lot of the games are already named, but I think they show some of that. And obviously like Balatro was kind of odd one. It was more just dude making game because he wanted to for fun and got caught on. But sometimes that's all it really takes. And it's if your expectations are low, that's not a bad thing, because that was the case with Vampire Survivors as well. He wasn't expecting success, but I think that helped both of them focus on quality. And that's the through line for me, is like focusing on quality and making stuff that you want to play, that you know is good, I think is a huge win. Because even if you don't succeed, you still get a game you enjoy playing.
How about you, Anil? What's next?
So for me, it's one that I've got a feeling not many people know of, but you will do if you're in the Web3 world like myself. That would be Scryce Studios. So they're the guys that made Heroes of Marvia. That had a very successful launch. They listed their token and they've got their game. And it's maybe exploring some new space where the interest in their token fueled a massive amount of downloads for their game. They're getting downloaded over 2.5 million times without really spending much money, just from driving through hype. And perhaps creates like a new revenue stream, because token transactions just between that and market making can generate revenue for the studio. Now, I think it's too early to really say how successful this will be compared to the other products. I think, again, in this sort of spell of doom and gloom in the games industry, what tends to happen is that people have to work out new tricks and see where comes next. Just off air, Devin said, and I think he was quite right to say this, that after the 2007 financial crash, what really happened, I feel, was mobile gaming came out of that. Not right away. It took a few years to get going, but by sort of time 2009, 2010, free-to-play was a thing, and then it absolutely exploded in the 2010s. Perhaps the return of AA gaming is one of those, but if there's a new thing to happen, perhaps it's not necessarily a platform, which is sometimes what happens, but it could be the distribution and the business model type of thing. And I will say that in this case of Scryce Studios and their project, perhaps there is some commonality between that and the AA games that we've mentioned. And that is, it feels like games where you have some sort of tighter community or interest or super fans to get that initial momentum together can burst out to make more of a successful product. And that could be where we go in the future. It feels to me that like where we are in video games at the moment is quite familiar to movies, I would say, where you've got these kind of super duper blockbusters that maybe some of these are still going to make money. For example, let's be honest, GTA 6 is still going to be pretty successful, isn't it? Is it going to sell over 150 million copies? Maybe not with the marketing budget, but probably it will do if you ask me. But equally, there isn't room for that many maybe on the top end games. So where does it leave for everyone else? And so maybe that is the answer. Maybe it is about trying to find some initial momentum, building from that. And that's going to be the new way to do business. Now, how does that scale for the really biggest players in the space? Not quite so sure, but sorry to steal your thunder a little bit, but maybe another game that's gone a bit under the radar this year that's had a very successful launch has been Tekken 8 by Bandai Namco. And what happened with them is that I feel that they lost a bit of momentum with their last release. And with this one, it seems like they really actually did listen to their community and focused on making a great game. They did a lot of streaming and beta streaming of it early, and it's been pretty successful for them. I think it's already sold 3 million copies. Whereas by contrast, you got WB Studios and NetherRealm, and they've made Mortal Kombat 1. And actually, that game has actually sold better than Tekken 8. So you might think, what's the point I'm trying to make? But the critical reception is pretty poor. If you look at the amount of people playing a game, it is dipped to like a very low number. And it looks like it's not going to come anywhere close to the previous Mortal Kombat that sold 15 million copies. And if you look at it on the surface of that game, has three sort of superhero characters in it. And there's a lot of rumors that essentially that game was supposed to be Injustice 3 that was quickly made into a Mortal Kombat game to put some money onto the profit books. And that's not the way to go. Whereas these community-led fares are being good. So Scry Studios is my call. And the bigger point I want to make is I thought that is maybe an avenue we'll start to see more of. Can it transition to the top studios? Not sure, but maybe there are some signs that it could do.
Yeah, and just to back up your point about Mortal Kombat 1, which I've been pretty critical of as well, it's also 40% off today right now. And that made me almost think about buying it, but that, I think that's a clear indicator that it probably didn't hit the mark despite being relatively successful in terms of a live service model where if people are leaving, we got to get some new people in. We're going to have to dip that discount, like put in the discount. And because most of the complaints were about the price plus the live service stuff. But like in terms of WB, I was hoping by now that I could be including multiverses on this list. We'll have to see if that will be maybe their successful live service because they are teasing it already. And I was hoping based off their tease, we would see something in the Xbox showcase, but not quite yet. Although I think maybe the McDonald's tie-ins in Europe were maybe just an artifact from before, but I think we might be getting it back. I don't want to overhype it. I'm excited because I enjoyed that game and it was free instead of being like the Mortal Kombat, like $70 plus kind of thing. Hopefully we'd cheer for the people that aren't trying to milk us and looking to just make a good game from, they are a smaller studio under WB. So like that would be almost be again, almost double A kind of status because they're very small.
Yeah. That's the point I'm making here is that maybe because there are some other commonalities of some other games that had, let's say, an off number in their franchise that didn't do well, and they had to rebuild that trust in the future one by listening to the community. So Street Fighter is another example of that. Street Fighter V launched and it was a hot mess. It was literally an unfinished game that was released and almost destroyed the franchise. And yet the new game that came out was like one of the most polished fight, in fact, probably the most polished fighting game on launch ever made. I wonder if the two were connected there. And I actually have a suspicion. I'd be curious if the Mortal Kombat case, like, I don't want to call out the devs here because I've got a feeling that they were probably pushed into doing some things they didn't want to do. And I wouldn't be surprised if the next one they decide actually, okay, to take their time a bit more on it and try and like maybe really make it good. Like, you know, like,
so Mortal Kombat 13 will be the one, right?
It will, of course. It's unlucky for some, but not in this case. But what I mean by that is this does happen sometimes at studios is that they'll target a Metacritic rating internally, right? So it could be like, okay, this game, we'll accept it if it's a 70, but it makes this amount in terms of the return. But the next one is, okay, it's actually more important that this is Metacritic 90, even if the sales aren't so good. And the reason they'll justify that is because what you don't want to do is completely ruin a franchise so that you've completely lost it forever. Because then that's, why would you want to do that? That's terrible things in the cross-media world that we live in. So maybe we'll see some more of that. And another one that's coming out quite soon actually is Dragon's Dogma from Capcom. And I'm curious what happens there because the first one also had similarities to that. It had like some, it was a good game, but didn't feel like it hit the mark. And again, it felt like it was a game that was rushed. This time around, it looks like they haven't rushed it. So let's see if this one is both a commercial and or a critical success. And maybe that is the case that people realize that you can't it's funny because we said that companies need to get more efficient, but maybe quality still got to be the benchmark that people shoot for.
Yeah, you've definitely got that sort of like every other sort of thing where people are really successful and then they try and cut corners on the next one. It backfires, but still makes some good money because people had expectations for the previous one and bought in. And then you take, okay, well, let's take that money that we made that we probably shouldn't have from cutting the corners and spend that money to make the next one good and revive the sort of quality of brand. And I think we see that a lot, even in movies, video games, whatever. It's like, do we revive this brand or we just keep cutting and see how far we can get down? And I think, let's make the next one better. Let's take that money that they invested in us because they have faith in us and make that come true in the next one. Not everyone does that, but I think that's a lot better of an outcome than like Modern Warfare 4 might actually be worth it, maybe, for example.
Nice. Well, yeah, I can wrap up with a couple of final ones. One, to put another Web3 theme on it, is Immutable. Obviously, crypto is having a resurgence for better or worse, and all things Web3 will ebb and flow with those tides. But I've been really impressed with Immutable, and some of this isn't in 2024, but I think what's most impressive is that, you know, 3 years ago, it really was an open question about if you were a developer coming into space, like what blockchain would you build on? What platform would you use? And Immutable has been able to, through honestly just like pretty brilliant entrepreneurship, been able to come up with a more definitive answer for the vast majority of teams. And of course, like they raise money well to last through bear markets. They've built their ecosystem and technology stack out, but perhaps most brilliantly is they turn competition into partners, such as with Polygon, and now you can get the best of both worlds through Immutable. But also, I think it was called Beam, if I'm not mistaken.
Merit Circle, yeah.
Yeah, by Merit Circle. And maybe they'll come out with more interesting deals like that in the future. But really, because of all of this, their own hard work and their partnerships, I think their market share is over 80% now of teams building in Web3 are now choosing to work with Immutable. And obviously, that doesn't mean that the money is being made yet, but we're starting to see like the business development wins. And I follow the founder, CEO, Robbie Ferguson on X, and occasionally he'll tweet out or post just random updates from their BD team. And the latest one, which was less than a week ago, was like, we hit a new record in 48 hours. We just signed 10 new like games teams. And I'm like, that's pretty...
One of them was my team.
Oh, there you go.
A little stealth announcement.
It's not stealth. That was announced. That too. Yeah.
So anyways, it's been really impressive to see how they've been able to maneuver. And now they just continue to accelerate the biz dev wins, which at some point will turn into accelerating revenue wins, probably starting in 2024, but really over the next few years. So that's been one. And then I'll also just shout out Roblox, of course. And there's not a whole lot new that is worth digging into here other than just the snowball of Roblox's compounding. It just continues to roll, especially as they've gone more multi-platform lately. Their user growth is just consistent year after year, and that enables them to grow their R&D budget year after year and just increase the capabilities on the platform year after year. And that just continues to roll. And the thing about compounding is, you know, at some point, the yearly changes you're able to start making just become larger than what anyone else can match. And so I've just been super impressed with how they've just like put their stake in the ground and just made it very clear that this is like a next era of gaming. And even as mobile flatlines, as consoles struggle for growth too, it's just more and more is gaining share in these platforms, Roblox in particular, and UEFN to a lesser degree. But man, it's so impressive just to see the consistency and the growth of this Roblox team. And they'll have ups and downs in the market as what people focusing on their earnings or whatnot in any given quarter get excited or freak out. But really, just that underlying compounding machine is intact and very impressive in difficult times. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff in the industry, and there are these big winners. And it's not always, even if the industry as a whole isn't in the best position, or companies find themselves more in red oceans and having to come out with new tactics to to stand out more than before. There still are these teams, whether it's the AppLovin's, the AAs, the Robloxes, the Immutables, that really are making the future their own. And it's, at least as a entrepreneur, it's pretty inspiring to see.
Definitely. And I thought you had a great discussion with David in the recent interview around a lot of the Roblox and UGC stuff. So I wanted to shout that out because I think that was useful to kind of highlight that industry that I do hope. And I mentioned earlier, that I think that's a big trend that I hope succeeds for the future of game development in general, in terms of game developers having a way to make money that makes sense for smaller people and things. Who knows, maybe it gets taken over by studios and there's not even kids making games for other kids anymore. But it does seem like there's an element of that will stay. And also I wanted to shout out that on the Immutable thing, a lot of their games maybe haven't come out yet, but they did finally get Gods Unchained onto mobile. So for those of you who didn't know that, it finally happened. I think it's still an early version, but it's playable now. So I think that's exciting because that's been their success that they've continued to double down on and make it better and make it grow since they don't have a ton out yet. And I also have played some Metalcore, and I think they've got that. Obviously, that's not their game, but it is going to be one of the early Immutable games. I think that looked like it was going the right direction. So I'm hopeful as a Web3 person myself that business can start to make some sense for a company that's doing it well, because it benefits us all, especially if now's bull time again, even better for that to try and come up and do something solid, because we know good games take time. So we're hopefully okay, is it time yet? We can have a lot more to talk about and not just have to make this a one-off segment of what's exciting this year, and that the tide turns of the conversation. But in the meantime, we'll definitely try and keep an eye out for the really fun stuff as well as the stuff that still needs to be talked about, even if it's not as fun. But I wanted to thank you guys, of course, for coming on as usual. Fantastic stuff, great insights as well. And of course, to the listener for continuing to tune in to what is hopefully a lot of good, insightful discussions on a lot of interesting things happening this year. I'm looking forward to it. And hopefully we'll see you at GDC. Make sure to, if you want to talk to Novik, hit up that form. We'll have that in the show notes. And make sure to do that. Or I guess if you, for some reason, can't find it, there's always email. But definitely let Aaron know and get that going in person, hopefully, because that's always much more fun. But in the meantime, catch you guys next week.
If you enjoyed today's episode, whether on YouTube or your favorite podcast app, make sure to subscribe, comment, or give a 5-star review. And if you want to reach out or provide feedback, shoot us a note at podcast@novik.co or find us on Twitter and LinkedIn. Plus, if you want to learn more about what Novik has to offer, make sure to check out our website, www.novik.co. There, you can sign up for the #1 games industry newsletter, Novik Digest, or contact us to learn about our wide-ranging consulting and advisory services. Again, that is www.novik.co. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you in the next episode.